After a while, I became impatient and tried to move, but the box was too narrow. My hands were crossed on my breast, so I could not rise them to help myself. I listened and then tried to call. My voice was gone. I could hear the trample of the horses attached to the wagon, and even the breathing of the driver. Then another sound broke upon my ears like the rising of a window sash. I managed to turn my head a little, and found I could look not only through the glass cover of my box, but also through the glass panes in the side of the covered vehicle. I saw houses, empty and silent, with neither light nor life about any of them excepting one. In that house, a window was open on the first floor, and a figure all in white stood looking down into the street. It was you. Tessie turned her face away from me and leaned on the table with her elbow. I could see your face, I resumed, and it seemed to me to be very sorrowful. Then we passed on and turned into a narrow black lane. Presently the horses stopped. I waited and waited, closing my eyes with fear and impatience. But all was silent as the grave. After what seemed to me hours, I began to feel uncomfortable. A sense that somebody was close to me made me unclose my eyes. Then I saw the white face of the hearse driver looking at me through the coffin lid. A sob from Tessie interrupted me. She was trembling like a leaf. I saw I'd made an ass of myself and attempted to repair the damage. "Why, Tess," I said, "I only told you this to show you what influence your story might have on another person's dreams. You don't suppose I really lay in a coffin, do you? What are you trembling for? Don't you see that your dream made my unreasonable dislike for that offensive watchman of the church simply set my brain working as soon as I fell asleep?" She laid her head between her arms and sobbed as if her heart would break. What a precious triple donkey I had made of myself. But I was about to break my record. I went over and put my arm about her. "Tessie, dear, forgive me," I said. "I had no business to frighten you with such nonsense. You were too sensible a girl, too good a Catholic to believe in dreams." Her hand tightened on mine, and her head fell back upon my shoulder. But she still trembled, and I petted her and comforted her. "Come, Tess, open your eyes and smile." Her eyes opened with a slow, languid movement and met mine. But their expression was so queer that I hastened to reassure her again. "It's all humbug, Tessie. You surely are not afraid that any harm will come to you because of that." "No," she said, but her scarlet lips quivered. "Then what's the matter? Are you afraid?" "Yes, not for myself." "For me, then," I demanded gaily. "For you," she murmured in a voice almost inaudible. I care for you." At first, I started to laugh. But when I understood her, a shock passed through me, and I sat like one turned to stone. This was the crowning bit of idiocy I had committed. During the moment which elapsed between her reply and my answer, I thought of a thousand responses to that innocent confession. I could pass it by with a laugh. I could misunderstand her and assure her as to my health. I could simply point out that it was impossible she could love me. But my reply was quicker than my thoughts, and I might think and think now when it was too late, for I had kissed her on the mouth. That evening I took my usual walk in Washington Park, pondering over the occurrences of the day. I was thoroughly committed. There was no backing out now, and I stared the future straight in the face. I was not good, not even scrupulous. But I had no idea of deceiving either myself or Tessie. The one passion of my life lay buried in the sunlit forest of Brittany. Was it buried forever? Hope cried no. For 3 years I had been listening to the voices of hope, and for 3 years I had waited for a footstep on my threshold. Had Sylvia forgotten? No, cried hope. I said that I was no good. That is true.